Chapter 41. Lama Beattie was a rake and a cad, but he was also a highly trained terrorist. Today was the most critical day, and he was leaving nothing to chance. Waking Ahmad in early afternoon, he slipped his hand across the Yemeni's mouth and then held up a slip of paper. It read, "No speaking from here on. Communicate in writing only, in Arabic." Ahmad nodded and sat up in bed. Taking a pad of paper and a pen from Lama Beattie, he scratched out a message. "Are the infidels listening?" "We never know," Lama Beattie wrote. For the next few hours, the two men communicated by notes. Lama Beattie laid out the plan. Ahmad made sure he understood the mission. Darkness had fallen over London before they were finished. Lama Beattie's last note was succinct. "I have to leave soon. You know where the Sword of Allah is located and what to do with it. Best wishes on your journey." Ahmad swallowed and nodded. His hands were shaking when Lama Beattie handed him a glass of arak to calm his nerves. It was only a few minutes later when Cabrillo decided to finally use Al-Khalifa's telephone to call the apartment. But by then, the two had taken the vow of silence. The telephone rang four times until it was picked up by the answering machine. Cabrillo chose to leave no message. The corporation's much-vaunted ace in the hole turned out to be of zero value.
"There's movement,"
one of the MI5 men assigned to monitor the parabolic microphone said over the radio. The time was just before 9 p.m., and a light snow had started falling in London. The temperature was just at the freezing point, and the snow was not sticking to the roads, merely wetting them. If the temperature dropped any more, they would become an icy mess. The buildings were becoming lightly shrouded, and puffs of steam escaped from the numerous roof vents. The remaining Christmas decorations in the windows added a festive nature to the scene, and the streets were crowded with holiday partiers. Except for the fact that a nuclear weapon was nearby, it was tranquil. Lama Beattie rode down the elevator. He had explained to Ahmad the way into the shop. The vehicle that would transport the bomb had been gassed and checked a week before. The Yemeni knew how to activate the timer. There was nothing else to do. Nothing else but to escape. Lama Beattie's plan was simple. He'd drive the Jaguar through the city to the M20. That would take him 45 minutes or so. Once on the M20, he would drive south to the train terminal at Folkestone, a distance of 60 miles, give or take. Once there, arriving a half hour early, as was required, he would drive the Jaguar onto the train scheduled to leave at 11:30 p.m. The train would just be exiting the underwater tunnel at midnight for its arrival at Coquelles, near Calais, at 5 past the hour. Lama Beattie would be out of danger from tunnel collapse just as the bomb ignited, but he would still be able to witness the fireball from the window of the train. It was a well-planned and well-timed escape. Lama Beattie had no way of knowing that several dozen MI5 agents, as well as the corporation, were watching his every move. He was a hare, and the hounds were drawing near. Lama Beattie exited the elevator and walked through the lobby and onto the side street. He glanced around, but noticed nothing amiss, other than a nagging sense that unseen eyes were watching. He felt confident and at ease. The feeling was just paranoia, he thought, the burden from the knowledge of the upcoming destruction. Lama Beattie shrugged off the thoughts, opened the door to the Jaguar, and climbed inside. Starting the car and allowing it to warm up for a minute, he placed it in gear and drove down the few feet to the Strand and turned right.
"I've got tracking,"
one of the MI5 men said through the radio. The box Truett had attached to the gas tank was operating perfectly. Near the entrance to the Savoy, Fleming and Cabrillo stood on the sidewalk and glanced at the Jaguar waiting to turn the corner. Fleming turned his back to the car and spoke into the microphone attached to his throat.
"Teams 4 and 5, follow at a distance."
The Jaguar turned, and a cab pulled from the side of the street and trailed at a safe distance. The Jaguar passed a small panel van marked with the logo of an overnight freight company a block down. The van pulled into the traffic and took up station at a discreet distance behind.
The Jaguar was clean. The bomb was not in it, Fleming said to Cabrillo. So, just where do you think Labobiti is going?
He's running, Cabrillo said, leaving the kid to do the man's job.
When should we move to intercept? Fleming asked.
Let him get to his destination, Cabrillo said. The airport, the train terminal, wherever. Then tell your men to grab him. Just make sure he has no chance to make a call before they take him into custody.
What then?
Fleming asked. Have him brought back here, Cabrillo said in a voice that chilled the already cold air. We wouldn't want him to miss the party.
Brilliant,
Fleming said. Let's see how bad he's ready to die for Allah, Cabrillo said. The closer it came to midnight, the more the tension increased. The microphones at Labobiti's apartment were picking up the sound of Ahmad praying aloud. Fleming was stationed in the hotel across the street with a dozen men from MI5. The three corporation teams had been at their stations for just over 13 hours. They were growing tired of the wait. Cabrillo was walking back and forth near Bedford Street. He'd passed the classic motorcycle dealership, a takeout curry restaurant, and a small market hundreds of times as he paced back and forth.
We have to go in there, one of the MI5 agents said to Fleming.
What if the bomb is a few blocks away, Fleming said, and someone else has started a delayed timer? Then we've missed it, and London burns. We wait. There is nothing else we can do.
Another MI5 agent walked into the lobby.
Sir, he said to Fleming, we now have 20 vehicles prowling the roads nearby. As soon as the principal climbs into whatever car he's going to use, we can stop traffic in an instant.
And the bomb experts are nearby, ready to move?
4 British experts, the man nodded, a couple from the United States Air Force.
At that instant, Ahmad's praying stopped, and the sound of him walking across the floor of the apartment came over the microphone.
We have movement,
Fleming said into the radio to the dozens of men in wait.
Do not move on him until he's at his final destination.
Fleming prayed it would soon be over. The time was 11:49 p.m. There were MI5 agents at the front, rear, and all sides of the apartment building. Every car on the street had been tagged with a locator. Each had an electronic disabling device attached. Each had been scanned with a Geiger counter and found to be clean. Everyone believed Ahmad would be driving to another location to retrieve the bomb. But the bomb was downstairs, right now. It was resting in the sidecar attached to a Russian-made Ural motorcycle, just like the one Ahmad had trained on in Yemen. As soon as the door to the apartment opened and Ahmad exited, an MI5 agent passed through the lobby and stared at the elevator button. It showed the elevator going to Labobiti's floor, and then it started down. The elevator stopped on the second floor. The MI5 agent whispered the information over the radio, then quickly walked from the lobby. Everyone who was listening tensed up. The time was now, and this was the place. The food and beer and fun had not been diminished by the cold and scattered snow. The areas around Hyde and Green Parks were crowded with tens of thousands of holiday partygoers. Backstage, a liaison from MI5 was explaining to a rock star the cold reality.
"Oh, you should have warned us," his agent said loudly, "so we could have canceled."
"He explained that," Elton John said. "That would have alerted the terrorists." Dressed in a yellow sequined jumpsuit, jeweled sunglasses, and black platform boots with lights in the soles, it would be easy to dismiss John as just another spoiled and overindulged musician used to a life of pampered elegance. The truth was far from that. Reginald Dwight had clawed his way up from a hard-scrabble existence with strength, perseverance, and decades of hard work. No one can dominate the pop charts for decade after decade if they're not both tough and realistic. Elton John was a survivor.
"The Boyle family's been evacuated, right?"
he asked.
"Come in here, Mr. Truitt,"
the MI5 agent shouted outside the trailer. Truitt opened the door and stepped inside.
"This is the stand-in for Prince Charles," the agent said.
John glanced at Truitt and grinned.
"Looks just like him," he said.
"Sir," Truitt said, "I want you to know we're going to recover the bomb and disable it before anything happens. We appreciate you going along with this."
"I have faith in MI5,
John said.
"He's with MI5, Truitt said. "I'm with a group named the Corporation."
"The Corporation?" John said. "What's that?"
"We're private spies," Truitt said.
"Private spies?" John said, shaking his head. "Imagine that! You guys any good?"
"We have a 100% success record."
John rose from his chair. It was time to go backstage.
"Do me a favor," he said. "Give this one 110%.
Truitt nodded. John was at the door, but he stopped.
"Tell the cameraman not to do close-ups on Prince Charles. The bad guys might be watching." "You're going out there?"
the agent asked incredulously.
"Damn straight," John said. "That's a crowd of my countrymen, and they came to see a show. Either these men,"
he swept his hand at Truitt and the MI5 agent, "handle this problem, or I'm going out singing." Truitt smiled and followed John out the door. There are six ways to enter a room. Four walls, the floor, or through the ceiling. Ahmad was using the latter. At the end of the second floor of Labibiti's apartment building, there was a utility closet. 2 months prior, Labibiti had carefully sawed the four corners of the wood-planked floor and removed it, revealing the subfloor. Then, using a 2-foot-diameter round hole saw, he bored a hole into the lower shop. Between the subfloor and the wood hatch above, he'd hidden a rope ladder. After cleaning up the dust below, he retrieved the round section of floor and reattached it above with twin plates. Next, he filled the edges around the wall in the closet with wood putty so it could not be detected. The hatch had been left alone until now. Ahmad opened the utility closet using a key Labibiti had copied. With the door open and the hallway empty, he pried off the hatch with a screwdriver. Setting the wood-planked section against the wall, Ahmad entered the closet and shut the door behind him. He took a pair of hooks from his pocket and screwed them into a wall, then attached the rope ladder. After removing the plates holding the round section of floor in place, Ahmad pulled it up into the closet and tossed it to the side. He dropped the ladder into the hole and climbed down. Every MI5 agent on the rooftops nearby had their scopes trained on the second floor.
"Nothing,"
they called in one by one. The MI5 agent who had walked through the lobby, then out again, re-entered the building. Walking over to the elevator, he saw the indicator light still on number 2.
"Still on 2,"
he radioed to Fleming. In the hotel across the street, Fleming was staring at his watch. 4 minutes had passed since the principal had stopped the elevator on the second floor.
"Go up the stairs," he ordered the agent.
Ahmad stared at his instructions written in Arabic, then flipped back the hinged panel over the arming mechanism. The symbols were Cyrillic, but his diagram was easy to follow. Ahmad turned a toggle switch up, and an LED light began to flash. Turning a knob, he adjusted the time to 5. Then he climbed on the Ural and kicked the engine to life. Once it started, he reached for a garage door opener duct-taped to the handlebars and pushed the button. He shifted into first and was doing nearly 10 miles an hour as the door rose 6 feet in the air and continued up. Everything began to happen at once. The agent reached the second floor and reported it empty at the same instant the garage door began to open.
"We have a door opening,"
Fleming said into the radio as he raced through the lobby for the door. He was just at the inner glass doors when the motorcycle appeared and drove onto the street. Ahmad was at the corner crossing onto the Strand in a second.
"The principal is on a motorcycle,"
Fleming shouted into the radio. The sharpshooters followed Ahmad, but he turned before the order to fire came. On the Strand, three taxis driven by MI5 agents heard the radio call. They pulled from the side of the street and tried to block the Ural. Ahmad swerved and took to the sidewalk to pass them, then angled back onto the road and twisted the throttle to the stops. Gaining speed, he swerved in and out of traffic like a madman. Ahead, a truck, driven by an MI5 agent, tried to block the road, but Ahmad squeezed past. "They're on to me," he thought. Now he just had to deliver the bomb to the chosen area or die trying. Either way, he'd be a martyr. Either way, London would burn. Cabrillo stared down the street and saw the vehicles from MI5 were being outfoxed. They had not planned on the principal using a motorcycle, and it threw a screw into the operation. There was only one thing to do, and Cabrillo did not hesitate. Yanking a newspaper rack off the sidewalk, he threw it through the window of the classic motorcycle dealership's front window. The burglar alarm started blaring. Cabrillo climbed through the broken glass. The 1952 Vincent Black Shadow on display had the key in the ignition. Using his boot to clear the edges of glass from the frame, Cabrillo stomped on the kickstart and the engine roared to life. He lifted the front end of the Vincent over the windowsill, clicked it into gear, and rode over the windowsill and down to the sidewalk. The Ural pulled abreast of the dealership, then headed down the Strand. Cabrillo twisted the throttle and leapt in behind. The Ural was fast, but there is no motorcycle like a Black Shadow. If the Ural had not had a block head start, the Shadow would have caught him within seconds.
"The principal is on a dark green motorcycle with a sidecar. He's heading down the Strand,"
Fleming shouted over the radio.
"He has the bomb aboard. Repeat, the bomb is in the sidecar."
The Robinson with Adams and King took to the air. Near Trafalgar Station, Jones and Huxley drew their weapons and aimed down the road. Hundreds of people were milling about, and they angled for a clear shot, but could find none. In front of the War Cabinet room, Murphy and Lincoln turned away from the Victoria embankment and started sighting down on Hyde and Green Parks. On Piccadilly Street, Cassim and Ross separated and began covering both ends of the street. Truitt was kept away from the others backstage until it was time to walk in front of the microphone. Stepping from foot to foot, he waited.
"It's time," John's agent said.
Truitt glanced over at the MI5 agent, but he was talking on the radio. So Truitt walked onto the stage and approached the microphone.
"Ladies and gentlemen," he said, "could you please join me in welcoming in the new year with England's favorite musician, Sir Elton John?"
The stage was dark except for Truitt. Then a spotlight appeared on Elton John sitting at an elevated piano, still dressed in the yellow jumpsuit. His head was covered with a British Army Kevlar field helmet. The introduction music for the song "Saturday Night's All Right for Fighting" started to play. A second later, John began to sing. Truitt walked off stage and approached the MI5 agent.
"He's headed this way on a motorcycle," the agent said.
"I'm going into the crowd," Truitt said. The Ural raced past Nelson's column with Cabrillo and the Vincent Black Shadow hot on its heels. Cabrillo wanted to open his coat so he could get to his shoulder holster, but he couldn't take his hands off the handlebars to get at the weapon. Twisting the throttle, the Vincent shot ahead and came abreast of the Ural just as they passed Charing Cross. Huxley and Jones ran into the street and tried to line up shots as the two motorcycles passed, but Cabrillo was too close and the crowds too great. At the intersection of the Strand and Cockspur Street, Cabrillo pulled up next to the Ural and kicked at Ahmad with his boot. The Yemeni swerved, but retained control.
"They're going straight down the mall,"
Jones shouted over the radio. Cassim and Ross started running down Queen's Walk toward the concert. Murphy could become excitable, but with a sniper rifle in his hands, he was always quite calm. Lincoln was spotting for him and scanned the parks in front.
"The only clear shot through the trees is when they almost reach the Queen Victoria Memorial," Lincoln said.
"The street around the memorial runs clockwise, right?" Murphy said.
"Correct," Lincoln said.
"I'll plink the bastard as he slows for the turn, JFK style," Murphy said.
"I've got them," Lincoln said, just catching the front end of the motorcycles.
Adams made a left turn above the old Admiralty buildings and started down the mall to the rear of the racing motorcycles.
"Head and shoulders," King said through the headset.
"Shampoo?" Adams said.
"No," King said. "Where I'm gonna shoot this little shit."
He sighted in his scope and regulated his breathing. The cold wind through the open door of the helicopter was making his eyes tear, but King hardly noticed it at all. Cabrillo glanced ahead. There was a line of food vendors and booths ahead, lining the circular drive where the Queen Victoria Memorial sat. They were nearing the edge of the concert grounds. He pulled alongside in preparation to leap over to the Ural.
4, 3, 2, 1, Lincoln said.
Murphy squeezed off around at the same time King let loose a quick volley from the helicopter. Ahmad was almost to the circle when blood burst from his head, chest, and shoulders. He was dead a second later, almost exactly the same time Cabrillo jumped from the Vincent across to the Ural. His hands grabbed a lifeless corpse. The Vincent hit the pavement in a shower of sparks and rolled end over end before stopping. Cabrillo tossed Ahmad to the ground. He bounced across the pavement like a crash dummy dropped off a table. Reaching for the clutch, he took the Ural out of gear and applied the brakes. The motorcycle rolled to a stop near the line of vendors. Cabrillo looked over at the timer. The countdown had just passed 2 minutes. He only hoped it was regular time and not metric time. Truett had made all of 20 yards into the crowd when he realized the mask had to go. As Prince Charles, everyone wanted to touch him. Once he peeled the mask off, people backed away.
"Mr. Cabrillo has control of the bomb at the Queen Victoria Memorial,"
Lincoln reported over the radio. Whooping sounds filled the air as the MI5 teams in the decoy cars attached their portable lights and sirens and raced toward the memorial. Blockers moved into place to stop traffic, and an air raid siren started to blare. Truett ran across the road to Cabrillo just as he was snipping the wire.
"She's still active,"
Cabrillo shouted as soon as he saw Truett. Truett glanced up quickly. There was a Ben and Jerry's ice cream truck alongside the road. He ran over and opened the rear door. The attendant started to say something, but in a second, Truett was in the rear, grabbing a block of dry ice in his gloved hands. He ran back across the street to where Cabrillo was rapidly taking apart the nose cone with a pair of Leatherman pliers. Cabrillo had just pulled back the panel when Truett arrived.
"Let's try freezing the firing mechanism," Truett said.
The timer was at 1:12.
"Go!"
Cabrillo yelled. Truett's gloves were frozen to the block of dry ice, and he could not feel his hands. He tossed the block, gloves and all, onto the nose cone, and then slid his gray hands under his armpits. The timer clicked a few more times, then stopped cold. Cabrillo looked over at Truett and smiled.
"I'm surprised that worked," he said.
"Necessity," Truett said through gritted teeth, "is the mother of invention."
Cabrillo nodded and reached for the voice microphone at his throat.
"I need the bomb guys at the Queen Victoria Memorial ASAP."
Fireworks erupted over the park and throughout London as the new year came. 2 minutes later, a car pulled up and a British officer climbed out. Soon another car arrived, containing an expert from the U.S. Air Force. 5 minutes later, the two men had the firing mechanism removed and stowed. Now the bomb was just a housing for an orb of enriched uranium. Its heart was ripped from its body, and with it went the life force that could bring death. While the bomb experts were rendering the device inert, Cabrillo and Truett walked over to Ahmad's body, which was lying in a pool of blood on the pavement. The radio had reported that Labbabidi had been detained and was now being brought back to London by helicopter. Elton John was still singing, and the sound filled the air. The scene around the motorcycle was being cordoned off by British military and intelligence officials, and most at the concert were unaware of what had happened. "Nothing but a kid," Cabrillo said, looking down. Truett nodded. "Let's get you to the medic to look at your hands." Kasim and Ross, who had arrived a few minutes after the timer was stopped, were wheeling the smashed black Shadow over toward Cabrillo. The classic motorcycle was a mess. The tanks and side panels were scratched, the handlebars bent, and one tire was flat. A perfect specimen of motorcycle history had been destroyed. Cabrillo looked at the motorcycle and shook his head. "I want you two to go back to the dealership," he said to Ross and Kasim, "and pay the man whatever his asking price was. Then I want you to ask him where to send it to be restored again."
"You're keeping it, boss?" Ross asked.
"Damn straight," Cabrillo said. Right then, Fleming appeared, and Cabrillo walked over to brief him. Labbabidi was being brought back to downtown London, but it would be weeks before he filled in the pieces.